of Waldo, Knox, and Hancock counties with news, information, ideas, events, goods, and services on newsstands Thursdays and on the web at waldo.villagesoup.com.
The time's 4 o'clock and you are tuned to WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and streaming online at WERU.org. Power for the People with your host Steve Call is up next.
Good afternoon and welcome to Power for the People here on WERU. I'm your host Steve Call. It's always good to listen to the station on the way in to the studio. And so listening to the Blue Station with Fritz was the usual treat today. But that does remind me to point out that it is indeed Pledge Week, which you know if you've been listening for a bit. And if you do want to pledge, it's the phone number is 207-469-6600. That's 207-469-6600. And I did my pledge about 10 minutes ago, just so you know. So the goal of Power for the People is to help Mainers understand their energy future, and indeed the energy future of the state of Maine, which is changing all the time, hopefully. And of course, that also includes getting people to reduce their energy costs at their homes or in their businesses. And that leads me to introduce today's guest, which is Scott Cowger, who is the co-owner of the Maple Hill Bed and Breakfast and Conference Center in Hollowell. Scott, are you there?
I am. Hi, Steve.
Hey, yeah, Scott. Welcome so much to the show. And I just want to say that one of the things that I enjoyed from browsing your website was that your theme for your life, I guess, and for your business is social responsibility. And don't we wish everybody did a little bit more of that, I guess I would say.
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, we all need to do our part. We're really going to make major change in the world. You can interpret that any way you want, but I think we want to make an impact on climate change as a serious threat. It's incumbent upon all of us to take part.
Well, that's right. And, you know, I teach at Thomas College, as you know, and teach the environmental courses there. And sustainability is one of the themes of those courses. And, you know, it's kind of inescapable if we do things sustainable, we might stick around on the earth for a while. And if we don't, it may not work out so well.
That's right.
So there we are. And that is just an excellent lead-in to why you're the guest on this program, because we're going to talk about your bed and breakfast and conference center as a case study, and frankly, I'm going to call it a success story, if you don't mind, about your efforts on the energy front and the sustainability front there at your business. And so this is indeed a case study program, which I hope can be a bit of an inspiration to people for their own homes and for people in their own businesses, for example. In the interest of full disclosure, I do want to say that I've attended numerous conferences and meetings at Maple Hill, at the Conference Center. I haven't stayed there, but I've been to the Maple Hill in a number of times.
Right.
We've chatted a number of times there since I started doing this program several years ago. And so we've danced around the fact that I'd love to have you on the show, so we finally got around to doing it.
Great.
And in fact, I think we've actually known each other since sometime in the 90s when you were at DEP and I was director of the USGS Water Center at UMaine, if I remember correctly.
Right.
Does that sound right?
Absolutely. Yeah,
right.
And I had a stint of 10 years in the legislature, too.
That's right. Correct. Well, I've got a few notes here that I just want to mention, mostly that I acquired off the website and some from personal knowledge.
Sure.
But let me just give a brief introduction and then turn it over to you to flesh that out a little bit more. So you indeed served in the legislature from 96 to 2000. And I will say that you are very active on environmental and energy issues. You've owned and operated, co-owned and operated the Maple Hill Farm and Conference Center since 1992. I did not know you'd been there that long. And you've just done lots of energy projects. And again, that's really the reason for having you on the program. But tell us a little bit more about first yourself and then a little bit more of the background, I guess, not the details yet, for your facility.
Sure. Well, it's a pleasure to be on the air with you today. Well, I'm a native Mainer, grew up in Brunswick, went away to college, but then realized how much I missed Maine and came home and have been here ever since. But I've had a real passion for the environment throughout my life and really enjoyed applying that in the legislature on the Natural Resources Committee. And it was been fun to put my money where my mouth was to do a lot of projects here at the Inn and really be a showcase, not a showcase, that's kind of a over-the-top word, but be an example for others to follow. So I'm very happy to be a case study today. And it's also nice to leave a legacy. I don't have any children, so creating a business that will be sustainable both from a business perspective but also from an environmental perspective means a lot to me.
Well, we need more people to be doing that sort of thing, for sure.
Yeah.
So just a bit of information here for our listeners. Our second telephone line is not operational today, so we can't take any phone calls because Scott is on the other line with us. But you certainly can drop us an email with any comments or questions, and that email address is news@weru.org, and we'll get your comment or question on the air as soon as possible. So feel free to chime in with us there. I'll mention, Scott, I'm also a native Mainer, and I've left twice, once for a job right out of college and another time a job offer that I couldn't refuse. But I've come back twice because the bottom line is I want to be here, too. I like the climate. I like the people. And it's just I'm just comfortable here.
Yep.
Your quote about putting your money where your mouth is such a good one. Listeners to this show know that I've got solar power on my place at the lake, and have not paid a electric bill have not bought any electricity. But of course, we don't actually buy electrons; we rent electrons. So I haven't rented any electrons from the utility since 2011. 9 years without where I've been generating more power than I've used, and I feel really good about that.
Well, congratulations! We talk with a lot of guests because we attract a lot of guests who care about sustainability and the environment, and I get to sort of get my little case studies of individuals from all around the country too, and I hear their little stories, and people are very proud when they come in and say, "I've got solar, and I'm not." Buying electricity either, so it's been fun for me to see, learn from other people too.
Well, that's exactly right. So tell us a little bit again. Realizing now that you purchased the facility back in 1992, what was it that you purchased, and that will kind of set the baseline for the rest of our conversation here in terms of the things that you've done.
Sure. Well, I fell in love with the property back then. I'd been kind of looking at various bed and breakfast to buy. I drove in the driveway, which at the time was a big rutted drainage ditch that I could barely drive up. Things changed a lot since then. And I just fell in love with the place. It was a large farmhouse, but a small B&B. Just had six rooms at that point. And some of them shared bathrooms. Fairly primitive, old heating systems that were very inefficient, and the hot air system had fumes that would even sort of smell them throughout the building in the beginning. But I had a vision for making it much greener eventually. It took some time to try to make a living at it at first, and then we also built on some major additions, get more guest rooms and amenities, and also the full-service conference center that can seat up to 150 people indoors and up to 300 in the summer and fall time with a tent we add on there. We've built on a big commercial kitchen, so we do all the custom catering in-house, full bar service, and really anything somebody needs for a room set up for any sort of event. We've done everything in the world. And then the inn just has 8 guest rooms now, but all private baths, many of them with big double whirlpool tubs, and, fireplaces, and some private decks, lots of really nice amenities that don't really exist anywhere else in the Augusta area. So we really see ourselves as an alternative both to, holding a meeting at a place like a civic center or something, or staying at a hotel in Augusta or anywhere in the area. We are the alternative, sort of small-scale personal service kind of atmosphere. And while we are in Hollowell, we love the smallest city in Maine here in Hollowell, which is a thriving little downtown with wonderful restaurants, music, entertainment, all sorts of stuff going on. And yet we also really market to the Augusta, the capital area. You get here by taking the Augusta exit to find us. It's been a fun business to grow over the years.
And I presume you didn't do all that renovation at once. You did kind of build into it. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. We started, there was a small building next door, which is still there, right across the driveway. We started doing small meetings in that space. We would do big weddings under tents in the summer and fall. We did very much grow slowly into it. I think we had sort of three major construction projects to do everything we wanted to do here. But that was certainly, that was about 10 years after starting with this. But the first thing we did was tackle the heating systems in here that were just terribly outdated, inefficient. And the first thing that I think was made a big energy savings, but also gave a lot of comfort to the guests, was we put about 20 zones of heat throughout the old inn. So every guest room, every common space, everything has its own zone. And we could then just heat what we wanted, and the guests could control their own heating and air conditioning, rather than just running off a big central power plant that, whoever got the thermostat in the hall could control it.
Well, I make the case on this program and in talks that I give around the area about, frankly, I call it the economic imperative of us moving as a society to renewable energy, us being the planet, frankly. But one of the things that that people miss, and I'm glad you just made that comment about comfort, is that if you insulate a place well, and if you have multiple zones or put in, mini splits in your home or something so that you've got individual control in particular rooms, you're just plain more comfortable.
Yeah.
And, saving money is great. Saving money is essential, but it also, you don't want to save money and freeze to death.
Yep.
And when you do these things right, and you're just more comfortable.
Absolutely.
And
Absolutely.
That's, it's hard to put a dollar value on that.
Right. Yep. So, good point.
So
yeah, people, I think in the beginning when B&Bs and hotels were saying, we're green, we're sustainable, I think people were worried that would put guests off. They were going to have to be roughing it. Not being able to take a nice hot shower or whatever, but that's nothing could be further from the truth. It's all to accentuate the visitor's experience, not to take away from it at all.
Well, and that was one thing that I wanted to mention right up front with you, is to get your 2 cents worth. Again, using you as a model for other, I guess in this case, businesses, not so much homeowners, but ignoring the amount of energy savings you have. I would think that that your focus on energy issues, and in fact, you actually have an environmental policy on your website,
mm-hmm.
has got to be great for business and helps make you unique. Can you comment on that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would say in the beginning, when we first started doing things, we were sort of ahead of the curve, and people weren't quite sure what to think about it. But it didn't take long. A couple of years later, people were very excited about going to a quote unquote green property. And Maine started the Environmental Leader Program for Hospitality. It was a state-designed program to certify hotels and other lodging establishments as sustainable. We were very proud to be the first property in that program. That was in 2005. And that also gave the travelers sort of some place to go if they wanted to find a green property. See this list of hotels. Of course, there are many other ways to find that now. But it certainly is much more than our energy savings, because the investments we've made have some fairly long paybacks, especially at the time we made them, that we didn't do it strictly for the money. Sit around and analyze things and just trying to make the best economic decision, you could be doing that forever and ever and ever. And at some point, you just have to jump in if you really want to make a mark, and that's what we've done. Probably not the best business decision, but ultimately it probably is, because we do attract a lot of folks. And we'll talk about the wind turbine, for example, but that's it's a very visual aspect of our property. not near the inn. It's far enough away so it doesn't bother anybody with noise or anything. But it makes a very strong visual statement as you drive in the driveway and you see that. And very proud of that, even though there's some very marginal paybacks with our particular location here for wind.
Well, you were an early adopter, and that means you were on the front edge of the economics, and the economics for all of these things is far better today than it was then. But you've made a go of it, and it's been good for your business. And again, I think everybody needs to think about that intangible relative to better marketing. I mean, green is a word that's thrown around too much, but you've made it real,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And let me just mention, I'm not even sure I can get all these straight here because I've got kind of scribbled notes from your website and from things that I've saw on some other links from publications, but you just mentioned you were, I guess, one of Maine's first environmental leaders, a certification from the DEP.
We were the first one.
The first one, okay.
Kicked off the program here at the end of an environmental conference that was going on.
Fantastic.
Sort of surprised me by giving me the first designation.
No, they surprised you on that one. So, that was a DEP one for in 2005, if
correct.
I'm looking at my notes correctly. It looks like you also won a Governor's Award for Excellence in 2004.
Correct.
For renewable power and sustainable energy practices.
Yep.
There was the Eco-Friendly Inn Award in 2015. Not sure who that came from. That was a national group, I think, wasn't it?
Yes, I'm trying to remember which one. We have quite a few.
There have been so many you can't remember, right?
What's that again?
There have been so few you can't even remember
exactly all
they are.
Yep.
You got Yankee Magazine's Best of New England Award in 2015.
Right.
And then you actually emailed me that in 2017 you got Yankee Magazine. They named you one of the best five green hotels and inns in all of New England.
Yeah, that's our proudest achievement. You know, the important thing is these aren't things you apply for. They're not competitive contests or anything. You get a call from the magazine saying, you know, if you've got a picture, you can send us or whatever for this great article you want to do. It's just very rewarding to get those sorts of things. And that's sort of stuff you can't, from a business perspective, you can't buy that kind of advertising. But when you get an award that lasts forever, that really means a lot. And people clip these articles and tuck it away. And 4, 5, 10 years later, I've had people show up, and we always ask every guest how they heard of us. And people refer back to ancient awards at some time.
Well, as you say, you can't buy that kind of advertising.
Right.
So that's, again, it's a big part of your business success, without a doubt.
Right. And again, we didn't do it. You know, I didn't say, look, I'm going to get lots of green guests. I did this. We both did this, both owners, because this was the right thing to do. And we knew it would be good for business in the long run, but it wasn't like we didn't have a business plan doing any of this stuff. It's kind of crazy about it.
And another part of it is, and this kind of relates to the comfort that I mentioned a moment ago, that you're more comfortable in an energy-efficient home, but the comfort of doing the right thing is
correct.
Also something you can't put a value on. And I mean, so I generate more electricity than I use at my place at the lake.
Mm.
Do I care? No. I mean, I feel great about that. And, you know, I know, I mean, I pay $6.62 to the utility for line access.
Right.
I don't use any electricity and literally haven't since 2011. And I just feel great about that.
Wonderful. It is a good feeling. Absolutely.
So you self describe yourself on your website as that your facility is deep green. I love that. Let's get into a few details here.
Sure.
Just after I remind everybody who we are speaking with, the guest today is on the phone is Scott Cowger, the co-owner of the Maple Hill Bed and Breakfast and Conference Center in Hollowell that has won all of those various green and renewable and energy awards that we've just been talking about. And so we're kind of going to run through his experience as a case study. And again, feel free to drop us an email. The phone line is not available, but you can drop us an email with a question or a comment to news@weru.org. So let's see. Did the wind turbine come before the solar power?
Yeah. Wind turbine came in 2003. Put that in.
So tell us a little bit about how you wound up doing that research, and
sure.
And we'll maybe that's not the biggest success story, so we'll start there and things will get better.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, yeah. Well, I mean, the wind turbine, we're on sort of the crest of a hill here, and we thought we'd have constant wind speeds, and thought it might be a good idea to put a wind turbine up on top of the hill. There was a tree in the middle of the field that had flagging, and I don't know if you guys know what that is, but I didn't at the time either, but the tree was growing much more in one direction than the other. And a requirement for getting a low-interest loan from the state for the wind turbine, and we think at the time it was the Public Utilities Commission, I think it even predated Efficiency Maine. The indication of that tree having that flagging was enough evidence for them to say, sure, we'll finance the wind turbine for you, or part of it anyway, certainly not all of it. And we thought that was worth the chance. So we put a wind turbine up. We put it on a 100-foot tower to get up above the adjoining tree line because you don't want to have turbulence affecting the nice flow of wind. And it's provided a slow, steady supply of electricity ever since then. But turned out we have a lot of quiet days here and a lot of calm days, I should say, without wind. And it's going to be quite a long payback period for that wind turbine, like something like 30 years. And I was just so excited about the opportunity to do it that I didn't dig in and do enough research probably. But wind turbines need to be on the coast or on mountaintops where there really is a continuous wind to make them economical. Anyway, and this whole area in central Maine here where we are, is not really a good spot for a wind turbine anywhere.
Right.
But it's going to pay for itself, and really, as long as it pays, the electricity will pay for the cost of the equipment over the years. And little maintenance, very very little maintenance is needed, which is a good thing because it's 100 feet in the air.
Right. The helicopter rental is expensive.
Yeah. Well, I have a tower that can actually lower down. I can bring the turbine down to the ground to, when it does need work. So I'm proud that it's going to pay for itself, and that's really all that matters in this case. But there is no energy saving per se.
All right, it's
the most visible aspect of everything.
That's exactly what I was just going to say. It is a visual impact when you drive into the parking lot. And it immediately gets you thinking about what's going on and makes you look at the other stuff more carefully than
right.
you might otherwise.
Right.
So yeah, you're absolutely right that the general advice for a homeowner is that a small wind turbine is not going to be the best investment. And as solar panels have improved in their efficiency through time, they've kind of, frankly, outpaced residential
yeah.
wind turbines without a doubt.
Yep.
There
yep.
is a wind turbine company in southern Maine, you can Google that, claims that they make the most efficient residential wind turbine around. And so if you are on a hill on your farm or something like that, and you're interested in looking into that, you certainly can. Presumably, I mean, there is a bit of an advantage on a windy evening when the sun isn't shining that you do get a little bit of renewable energy out of it. Mm-hmm. But again, your 30-year payback is kind of a not an unexpected reality check.
Right. And again, the wind turbines have gotten, even from the company that I bought it from, they have gotten a lot more efficient as well. So, again, being an early adopter, you're always one step ahead of future technology, I guess.
Right. We have talked a little bit about this on this program, I guess not for a couple of years. So you have a horizontal axis one, and so in other words, it looks like a windmill that anybody would recognize as a windmill, mm-hmm. and it's just a smaller, much smaller version of some of the industrial ones. There is a vertical axis wind turbine out there, which for residential uses, and it operates at lower wind speeds, but again, it doesn't have a tremendous output. I mean, yours is a 10-kilowatt machine, and I don't think the vertical ones are even that big. But if you are really interested in looking into it, not you personally, but anybody listening, certainly, take a look at what horizontal options are and also look at what the vertical options are. There's only one I know of in Maine. It's actually in the Augusta area, and I won't say where it is, but there are some of the vertical axis ones around.
Right. I've seen it myself and was fascinated by it. Yeah.
Right. I've stopped in and chatted with him a couple of times. And again, I think it's only 2 or 3 kilowatts, something like that. I'm not really sure. So then you, so that was in 2003. And so your solar went on in 2006, I believe?
Correct.
So tell us a little. Oh, actually, let me just back up just for a second. So net metering is something we've talked about a number of times on this program, especially because of the last gubernatorial situation where solar and net metering was, shall we say, unpopular.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me how the net metering worked way back, beginning back in 2003, what your experience was with the wind turbine in particular.
Well, we have quite a large electrical demand here at our facility. We've got, you know, a commercial kitchen and just a lot of space. So we did have net metering, but we very rarely have any excess to get credit for. Once in a while, we get a little bit more. But it was very easy to do. Just you have to sign this incredibly lengthy contract with Central Maine Power, but it sort of benefits both parties to lay it all out. In our case, we actually have 2 physical meters. One for electricity coming into the facility and one for electricity that we might send out.
And did they require that back in 2003?
They did.
Okay.
They did. I think a lot of it had to do with the size of our electrical demand, perhaps. I'm not sure if they still require 2 meters or not. I would hope not. But.
Well, they did as part of gross metering, which has not since been repealed. So I don't think that is still true. But some people back at the end of the LePage administration did have to wind up installing 2 meters.
Okay. So it was, you know, we laid that groundwork with net metering. So when I'm sort of jumping ahead, when we came along with the solar later on, it was, I just didn't even have to amend the agreement or whatever. Just had to let CMP know that more stuff was coming online.
Oh, is that right? That's interesting. Okay.
I actually don't really remember the details of it at this point.
So your solar in 2006, and this was a new bit of information for me, was actually at the time the largest solar array in the state of Maine at 15 kilowatts.
It was, and it was the largest one for many years after that. And I think it was one of the Hannafords here in Augusta that put a large array on their roof that finally surpassed us. And I'm happy to say that we're nowhere near the largest array these days.
Well, yeah, it's unbelievable, quite frankly. So you were the largest array at 15 kilowatts in 2006.
Right.
I can't speak to the one at Hannaford. You're probably talking about the one at Coney Circle.
Correct.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure about when that one went on, but according to Revision Energy, when they installed 170 kilowatts at Thomas College, where I teach. That was the largest array in Maine in 2012.
Great.
So we went from 15 to 170 over those 6 years.
Mm.
And the next largest array, well, so, I mean, Bowdoin and Colby and places like that, and numerous places have in the 1 to 3,000 kilowatt arrays. Mm. And there's one going in Farmington at 75,000. So
yep.
From 2006 until 2020, we've gone from 15 kilowatts as the largest array to 75,000. That's the change in the solar industry, shall we say, that's happened. And I might add, I did the calculation, so I'm pretty sure I'm correct on this. Your panels are probably 120-watt panels?
I think that's correct. I'd have to look again. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you said you had 126, so I just did the math. 120-watt panels in 2006. In 2011, I think I put on 210.
Yep.
And now they're selling 340 and 350 in the same space, the same size panel. So, again, we both ramped up the amount of energy that comes out of them, and we've ramped up the amount of energy that comes out of a total array, and we've ramped up the amount that comes out of an individual panel.
Mm.
And the price, while that has been going on, the price has come down.
I know. That's amazing.
And we just can't talk about those realities too much, I don't think.
Yep.
So your net metering agreement with the agent, with the utility, was basically a straightforward amendment process. Just just let them know, and you just continued on with net metering from there.
Correct. Very simple.
And it just I always want to be sure that we don't use terminology here that anybody out there is not familiar with. Net metering, in its simplest form, just means that if you're generating more electricity than you're using, you're running your meter backwards and getting a credit. In your case down there, you don't do that very often, you said, because of your high electrical demand. But what that means is if you're offsetting 20% of your electrical use, the meter is running 20% slower than it would otherwise. So, in effect, you're getting a credit for it in that manner as well.
Yeah. People often ask me if we get paid for the excess. And I say, well, we don't get paid, but we get a full credit. And, a full retail value of electricity as a credit is much better than getting paid some wholesale rate or whatever.
Right. And, in effect, you're using the grid as a battery.
Correct.
Which maybe sounds a little bit funny. But the you generate power back onto the grid, and then Central Maine Power, in your case, sells that to somebody else. So it's not like they're paying a penalty of any kind. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the PUC themselves, their own staff, did a report a couple of years ago that valued solar generated electricity at 33 cents a kilowatt hour, and which is about double the actual cost that CMP charges. And so solar power. If they were a Maine company, they would, just like in Vermont, they would celebrate solar power. But, of course, they're a Spanish company, and so they don't. just stating a fact.
Yep.
No particular opinion expressed, hopefully, there. Just stating a fact.
Well, and also, the state laws, everything varies state by state. So in Maine, we have the ability to do net metering because the legislature told the power company shall allow this. And I've, again, chatting with other guests from other states, who will remain nameless, apparently it's incredibly hard to do net metering in some states. It's not impossible.
My understanding is that last I checked, 46 states allowed net metering.
Oh, good.
And they kind of, once in a while, Nevada went away from net metering, and there was so much protest that they adopted it again. and net metering is the simplest of all possibilities. Your meter is keeping track. The meter runs backwards when you generate more electricity, and it runs forward when you use electricity, and they just bill you the difference.
Yep.
So,
yep.
It's so much simpler than some of the other things that have been tried. It was the easy way in, and I just celebrated being the easy way in general. You mentioned that people ask if you get paid for the electricity, and we don't in Maine, but that's just a state regulation. In New Hampshire, I did a net zero energy project on a town building over in New Hampshire. Actually, it was in the foothills of the White Mountains, and we got a grant from the Department of Energy to do a deep energy retrofit on a building. You can identify with that
yeah.
phrase. And we said, our goal is to do net zero energy for this building. And so the Department of Energy came back and said, well, you're doing a small town building which people can identify with relative to their own homes. You're not doing the gigantic town hall. But are you crazy? You can't do net zero energy in New England. And the bottom line is that building is used somewhere between 3 and 4 megawatts less than it is produced since 2012. So we blew the doors off, out of the water on that one. And the reason I'm mentioning this, in the New Hampshire case, the PUC, once you generate a certain amount of credit, does pay you, requires the utility to pay you for that electricity.
Okay.
So I mention that every now and then on this radio show that maybe we can twist the arm of our main PUC to get something like that
to happen.
There
we go. Sure.
So you also have solar hot water on your facility. Tell us a little bit about that.
Correct. Yeah, we put that in at the same time. We did a solar electric 126 PV panels, and then we put in a long array, 202 evacuated tube solar collectors.
That's a huge array.
Hot water, yeah. It's so much that, it does, I think, almost all of our domestic hot water for the inn, again, with 8 guest rooms and big double whirlpool tub. We have a good hot water demand. And then in the wintertime, when our guests are fewer, we have plenty of rooms in the wintertime, by the way, we actually use it for some radiant heat. We tapped into that, put some special controls in so we could heat some of the newer additions to the inn off of solar, which is unusual. Solar isn't usually used for space heating, as you probably know, but we try try to use that off-season thermal energy that we're collecting.
And you can do that even in the wintertime when the sun is low.
Yes, yeah. These panels are so incredibly, I mean, these evacuated tubes are just so efficient. We have a little light that comes on when the heat exchange fluid is flowing up to them, and it just doesn't need much sun at all for that light to come on. It's a wonderful little thing to see.
So the details of how you do that plumbing for radiant heat is more than we want to go into here, but tell me about your storage. You must have some significant storage.
We have two, I believe there are two 180-gallon tanks in the basement, and I'm tempted to could easily add a third one, I think, and that's on the list of things to consider as well. And basically, the solar hot water heats up in these tanks up to quite a high temperature. I forget, like 175 degrees. And then it goes from there into our boiler, which would be the traditional supplier of our hot water. And if the water is hot enough, the boiler doesn't need to come on.
Right.
It sort of passes through. Yeah. But if it's not quite hot enough, it's preheated, so the boiler just sort of tops it off, and we're saving energy, you know, year round.
Yeah. No matter what, you're saving energy.
Yeah.
Right. So occasionally you'll see. So the evacuated tubes are tubes that are 3 inches in diameter, something like that,
mm-hmm.
and so they're a dark color, and not to be confused with solar PV, which is a flat panel. So you see them around on houses fairly frequently for hot water. If you happen to see a set somewhere, speaking to the general audience here, that are vertical on the side of a building, that typically is what where they have dedicated those to heating of the building. Because they're not going to overheat in the summertime, and they are going to collect the low angle heat from the sun in the winter. So it's not unusual to find that. But your combination of getting domestic hot water and then using some when you can for heating is a unique, almost unique application. And I applaud you for doing that. So we talked, don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves here. We talked about the wind turbine having as much as a 30-year payback. What are you looking at for the payback on your solar PV?
Well, I haven't really looked at the PV versus the hot water system, but sort of the project as a whole, we think about it probably about a 10-year payback. So when in 2006, we think it's probably paid for itself by now. We were fortunate enough to get a loan from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. I think they still have it, I'm not sure, but they did have at the time a very competitive grant program.
That's a rural energy grant. Right.
And that paid for 25% of the cost of our solar project, which was a really important thing because it was a very expensive project, especially back then when these panels were worth probably cost 8 or 10 times the equivalent sort of wattage today. And having taken that, even taking that 25%, I'm sorry, I may have said loan, but it was 25% grant to help pay for the system. So even taking that into account, that take that cost off the top, we were still looking at about a 10-year payback, we think. It's kind of hard to do the exact analysis. We don't meter what's coming off the solar array directly, and then I don't really measure the hot water that comes off the solar versus what we use. So it's kind of a guesstimate of mine.
I think that's a very reasonable guesstimate. In fact, when I put mine on in 2011. I estimated that it would be actually in 2011. I got a little bit of money rebated from Efficiency Maine, which now has disappeared for solar. But I guesstimated that it was on the order of an 8-year payback. And one thing that I do talk about on this program from time to time is because a lot of people seem to think, "Geez, it's a 10-year payback. That means I'm out money for 10 years." And that's not what it means at all. What it means is, a 10-year payback means you've got a 10% return on investment. And in today's stock market, maybe that's not so great, but where else can you get a 10% return on investment where you know that's what it's going to be year after year?
Yeah.
Or it might even improve if the electrical rates continue to go up. So, again, just a different way of looking at it. The industry always uses the payback, and I'm not convinced it's always the best marketing strategy.
Right. And in our case, because what we have now is considered a fairly old solar array, because of we need so many panels to get 15 kilowatts. The payback for the hot water system is much faster than 10 years. And probably the PV system is probably longer than 10 years. That's why I sort of average it all together as one project.
Right. Actually, I have an interesting story on solar hot water. I put solar hot water on my house, my last place I lived in New Hampshire. And I did it. This was really before heat pumps came out, and so we, in fact, did replace our 1978 boiler with a new oil boiler, which was way more efficient and used 50% less oil. We put solar hot water on at the same time rather than buying the whatever you call the unit that goes on your boiler to produce domestic hot water. And that cost about the same amount of money as the solar array. So New Hampshire Public Television was there filming this. We were just making the case for solar energy in general. And at one point, a reporter came up to me and said, "So what do you think the payback period is?" And I literally said, "Well, I'm pretty sure it's going to be paid back on Tuesday." because instead of buying something that used it, fossil fuels, we were going to use solar immediately for the hot water. So
yep, yep.
I enjoyed saying that.
Great.
So just to remind everybody, we're talking with Scott Cowger here, who is the co-owner of Maple Hill Farm Bed and Breakfast and Conference Center in Hollowell, and has won all sorts of awards for his energy efficiency and sustainability work and infrastructure upgrades at this facility. And so we've talked about the fact that he has the high visibility wind turbine near the parking lot. The solar electric itself is quite visible. The solar hot water is a great way to efficiently capture the sun. And I guess remind us now, you've kind of touched on it a little bit, what portion of your energy cost do you think you're offsetting with these three things we've mentioned so far?
Yeah, we think we're getting about half our energy cost.
Okay.
Again, if we were to do this project today, given the higher efficiencies and everything, we'd have 100% of it. Given the system we have, we're halfway there.
Right. And again, these are 2006 panels, and the technology has changed phenomenally over time. But that's pretty impressive that you're getting half of your electrical use there as well. So fantastic on that. So let's talk about some other things that that you have done. I mean, we were standing in your kitchen or near your kitchen last time I was there a few months ago, maybe a year ago. I didn't realize that you'd done some upgrades there. So let's start with what you've done in terms of efficiency on appliances.
Sure. We're still looking at the kitchen stuff. We have some more work to do there. But certainly when we built our laundry system, our upstairs laundry system, versus when I used to have to go down in the basement and do things, it's awful. We put in some very efficient equipment. Put in a washing machine, where we got an actual rebate from Efficiency Maine for our commercial washing machine. Put in a couple very efficient propane dryers that sense the moisture level and don't run any longer than they have to. And these are big commercial dryers. And then we've certainly gone in, really, in, it's not an appliance maybe, but our lighting we have tackled in a big scale. Replaced over 800 light bulbs to get away from, we basically have all LED lighting that's mercury-free. As you know, fluorescent lighting, even the little compact fluorescent bulbs, all contain mercury. And I really wanted to get rid of all those and get rid of the maintenance aspect of that. I mean, we're always changing a light bulb here or there or somewhere.
Yeah, those LEDs were supposed to last a long time, but they really didn't. The LEDs are, the fluorescents were supposed to last a lot longer than it seems like they ever did.
Right. And we had, in our big conference room, we have some recessed lighting up in the ceiling, and we had put the compact fluorescents in there, and it's a terrible place to put them because the heat just builds up in these cans in the ceiling. And, these bulbs that deformed, the bases, plastic bases had deformed and would burn out quite regularly, and it was just an awful place to go. Some of these are LED lighting, that's really important. It was very important to us in the end to have a warm light. And when that was available, I worked with a Philips lighting company, happy to give them a plug. And they came and did an inventory of everything we had, which was, and I had no idea it was so much. And we did really a wholesale replacement of everything. And Efficiency Maine was very helpful at the time because some of these light bulbs were $25 a piece back then. Of course, you see them now everywhere, and they're much less expensive.
Yeah, they're dirt cheap. So Efficiency Maine actually gave you a rebate on those rather than having a buy down through a retailer. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, right. This was in the early days, and we actually had to. I think I got pre approval or something for it because it was a big project. Yep, and we're very thankful for that. But even to this day, we still have we keep discovering a few lights that we missed. You know, there's some of the fluorescent tube lighting in one of our other conference rooms and the kitchen and some other places. We just did that like 2 years ago. I didn't want to get into ripping out fixtures and putting new fixtures in and being disruptive that way. When the technology arrived where you could just replace the tube, we did that. And now we're finally looking at our parking lot lighting. We don't do a lot of evening events in our big parking lot, so it's not a lot of high-use lighting, but again, I'm anxious to get the parking lot lighting done, and then we can say we're 100% LED lighting at that point.
Have you looked into the possibility of solar parking lot lights?
I looked at it a little bit, yeah. But I think we may just stick with, I found a very neat way of just, there's a retrofit kit for the actual light model that we have that you just take parts out and put parts in, and they're also really, it'll improve the lighting quality as well that we have out there.
Right, and you've got the wires already in place. I mean, if you were putting in new parking lot lights and had to run wires, solar might well make sense, but typically it probably doesn't when it's just an upgrade.
Yeah.
Do you have any way, I mean, we haven't actually, well, I guess we've covered most of the things that you've done for energy reductions, and I know you've done these through time, so you probably can't answer this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you have any way of estimating or any estimate you've used for what your reduction in electrical usage has been as you've made various changes?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I haven't really tried to figure out what we've done. It's also sort of fascinating. After we did all the LED lighting, we ended up not saving a lot of money only because we're a business that has a peak demand charge.
Mm-hmm.
And that peak demand charge, cause thankfully you can go back and you can look at, you know, anybody can look at their information online with CMP, and you can see when that demand is. And for us, it occurs once or twice a month when we have an evening meeting, and so the solar's not working, the wind turbine's probably not spinning, and we have a big peak, and we still have to pay for that peak no matter what. And that's probably half our utility bills, is that peak demand charge.
Right. That's
That doesn't really go away very much. So again, we love, you know, we're actually gonna use less kilowatt hours because of the LED lighting. But we haven't saved a lot of money in our utility bill because of the demand charge.
Right. The demand charge is something that I think the average homeowner probably doesn't really focus on and doesn't typically show up on their bill. The analogy is if you've got a fire truck that could go, needs to fight a fire and put a lot of water onto the truck, you need a big hose to handle the water.
Yeah.
If you're an electrical user or a utility and you need to supply a lot of electricity at times to a particular customer, it doesn't matter what their average is. You need to have your wire, shall we say, big enough to handle that big charge, and that results in a charge called the demand charge because you use high amounts for short periods of time. And in fact, it's a 15-minute measurement is how they calculate that demand charge.
Mm-hmm.
There's an interesting story on demand charge from New Hampshire, again where I used to live, where we actually went on to time-based pricing with the utility. And, so the price over there was whatever it was, 14 cents a kilowatt hour for your average user. And I'm going to make these numbers up, but they're going to be close. We got, so the, on time-based pricing plan, we were got we were charged like 8 cents a kilowatt hour for at night, and maybe 22 cents a kilowatt hour from 4 till 8 or something like that. But the interesting thing was that the peak power charge, when you know, the grid is stressed on a hot summer day in August, take a guess what the kilowatt hour charge was for peak power.
5 times the regular rate.
$1.76.
Oh, wow.
Ten times the regular rate. But the beauty of solar power is, not so much in your case, because as you said, your peak power demand is in a meeting at night, but typically it's in the on a hot summer day when the air conditions are running in Boston. And that's when solar's doing its thing.
That's right.
So, you know, we could shave those peak prices right off and lower everybody's charge if there was more solar out there.
Well, then there's this whole fairly new idea of battery storage.
Right.
If we could have enough batteries here, and we've looked at it, it's just not cost-effective yet with the technologies that exist, but hopefully the cost will come down. I'm not going to be an early adopter of that one.
Right, yeah, that one's still a little bit on the early side, without a doubt.
But if the batteries can store the energy, it's in that little peak, then you can level that off, and that's incredible savings. And then, you know, we could generate, I'd put more solar panels out there and keep those batteries full, and it would be a wonderful solution. I see that as what's going to happen ultimately.
Right.
We'll still stay connected to the grid, but we really probably won't be using it much.
Right. Yeah, that's we didn't say that with the net metering, but clearly you are still attached to the grid so that you have that as your backup, whereas in an off-grid situation, you would certainly have to have batteries, and that's not the situation that hardly anybody has these days.
Right.
So we've only got a couple of minutes left here, but I noticed, actually, I guess you emailed it to me, that you actually have 4 electric vehicle charging stations.
Oh, yeah.
So tell us a little bit more about that.
That's our sort of latest thing we put in. We put in 2 charging stations, level 2 chargers, for those who know the lingo out there. And they're free for anybody who's here for an event or for lodging. And those will pretty much adapt to any electric vehicle. And then I also contacted Tesla, and they paid for 2 other dedicated Tesla charging stations that are also level 2 chargers. So we have seen a much more regular use of those with our events that are here. And because these show up on maps that electric vehicle users have either in their vehicle or on an app, we've seen guests that have chosen to stay with us because they can charge their car for free.
And again, you're the deep green facility there, and you'd think that electric vehicle drivers would indeed seek you out.
Yep. And I'm proud to say that I also have a third Tesla charger inside the garage for my Tesla. when my old car died, I said, well, I got to take the plunge. If I'm going to, again, put my money where my mouth is, I want to be green. So I guess that was sort of my excuse to buy a Tesla, too, perhaps, because I very much enjoy the vehicle.
Mm. Well, good for you. Glad to hear that. My biggest claim to fame there is I had a plug-in Prius, which my daughter now has. So it's hanging in there at 150,000 miles or something like that.
In fact, we
just drove it across country to Jackson Hole, where she's teaching for the winter. So it's been a great car, and you know, so I mean, in your case, the Tesla is 100% electric, and so we can all understand that. This was an early plug-in Prius, which only got like 15 miles of range, and everybody went poo-pooed that. But the bottom line is, if you get at 15 miles of range, you get 1,000 miles per gallon equivalent. All of a sudden, it's not difficult to get a tank of gas where you get 80 miles per gallon.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a little twist that a lot of people miss, I think.
It is.
So your level 2 charger that basically puts out 240 volts, and so you can charge a full EV in a few hours.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of yours are level 2. You advertise that as free.
Correct.
And what's your thinking on that?
Well, again, it's going to attract new business for us. You know, I'm thrilled to have a Tesla owner drive up and take one of our best rooms. That's good for business. It's going to cost me a couple bucks for power, and that's really extremely low cost for that. I also think that, you know, I have them individually switched so that perhaps someday they'll it'll be a small charge to use them. If the demand outweighs the number of charging stations, if we have eight people here waiting in line, well, then there'll probably be a small fee. But I'm not going to hold my breath for that day.
Right. And one of the important things is the equivalent price of electricity compared to gasoline is $1.35 a gallon.
Yeah.
And so it's not like tens of dollars to charge a car. It's a couple bucks, as you just said. Or, I mean, it's, you know, it's 60 cents to charge my plug-in Prius.
Yep.
It's, you know, there's all sorts of businesses out there, most of which are letting employees charge for free.
Absolutely. Yeah, there really isn't much of a cost to it. And the cost of putting in the stations is not much either. Really, they're very affordable. I mean, you know, the expense is going to be in paying the electrician to do the wiring.
Right. Tesla does charge Tesla drivers to charge on their machine, on their chargers, don't they?
Well, it depends. So Tesla has also these Level 3 chargers, the superchargers, and those are the ones that they control what's happening there. That's not what we have.
Oh, so they only—it's only the Level 3 that the Tesla
correct.
Driver has to put in a credit card number for.
Yeah,
and
it depends when you bought your car. And I'm proud to say again, as an early Tesla adopter, I never have to pay for supercharging. So I will drive across country someday and have a zero cost for fuel.
No, good for you. That's fantastic. Well, I will certainly keep my eye out for you driving around in a Tesla next time in Hollowell. So thank you so much for being a guest and giving us a little snippet into your business success that is in part based on the smart things you've done with energy.
My pleasure. And folks are welcome to contact me if they have questions.
All right. Yeah. Fantastic. I will follow up on email with you and thank you. But again, appreciate you being on the phone.
You bet. Take care, Steve.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
So this has been Power for the People. I'm Steve Kahl, and we've just been talking with Scott Cowger. And just a reminder that this is Pledge Week here at WERU, and give us a buzz if you'd like to at 207-469-6600. Thanks to Amy Brown, who engineered the program. Stay tuned for the Ralph Nader Radio Hour.